hard to imagine that the fellow did not have some grave mental problem, such was his rancor. It seemed as though he might, at any moment, leap across council table and come at Nubbins with a hidden dagger. But apparently this cruel and clever antagonist had no need for such weapons. His objections were universally taken under consideration, and just as universally sustained by the smiling judge. With each such telling point, the prosecutor would look over, resplendent in his ensemble, and openly sneer at Nubbins and his obviously overrated attorney. Nubbins was going deeper and deeper into a kind of shock. He had never been in a situation where the cards had been so obviously, so inexorably, so uniformly stacked against him. His attorney, he now realized, was fighting a holding action against implacable odds. He was simply outmanned by the same immutable stars that had brought Nubbins into this courtroom in the first place. Everyone was due for an unmitigated shitstorm at some time in his life, Nubbins figured, and this was clearly his turn. Attorney Cassidy, struggling valiantly in this lost cause, was making motions that the entranced Nubbins could not have possibly paid any attention to, else he would have detected the faint but unmistakable aroma of rotten halibut on the breeze. "Your Honor, I would like to make a motion e pluribus unum." "I object. He can't move for e pluribus unum in this proceeding. There isn't even a jury impaneled." "Sustained." "Well then, Judge, I would like to request a quid pro quo in order to..." "Objection! Clearly improper before the defendant takes the stand." "Sustained. Mr. Cassidy, I must warn you, sir. Please sit down." This went on long enough for Nubbins to clearly get the drift. Then Cassidy requested a recess in order to discuss something important with his client. Even this request was only grudgingly granted. As a group, all the court personnel, the spectators, and even Nubbins's timid girlfriend, sensing somehow that it was the thing to do, rumbled out of the room, leaving the lawyer and client alone in the large chamber. Cassidy, his borrowed horn rims cocked up on his forehead, rubbed his weary lawyer eyes. "Well, Jack, I guess you can see things aren't going so hot." "Yeah. That judge doesn't like you one little bit. And the prosecuting one, what's he got against me anyway? I don't know him from Adam's nephew." "Just doing his job, Jack, doing his job. But the chancellor, I think we may have a chance with him. He seems perturbed that we're dragging this thing out with a full-blown trial. Another lawyer told me once he likes to see people come in and lay it on the line. Otherwise, if you go through a trial and he still finds you guilty, he really throws the book at you." "What do you think we ought to do?" "I'm thinking we ought to go ahead and plead guilty and throw ourselves on the mercy of the court." "Steady," he thought. "Burst out laughing now and you'll blow the whole thing." "Well, you're the boss, you know that. We've come this far. Listen, Jack, I want you to know..." "Hey, I know. Listen, I thought you were doing a great job. Some of those motions, man." "Yeah, I should have won a couple of them at least. Anyway, let's give it a go. And Jack?"
"Yeah?"
"Remember, no matter what happens, I was there when you needed me." They shook hands solemnly. Nubbins was still sure he had a fine lawyer. Cassidy notified the bailiff, and everyone was called back in. Defense counsel advised the court that his client wished to change his plea to guilty as charged and to ask for the mercy of the court. He could barely get the words out. He dared not look at anyone as he spoke. They were all holding it together with sheer willpower. The judge seemed relieved by this announcement and thanked Cassidy for sparing the court a long and arduous trial. He then thanked the court personnel for their hard work. He requested that Nubbins rise with his attorney when he pronounced sentence. Since Cassidy had put several hours of work into the sentencing speech, he was gratified to see it delivered with the loving attention of a fine performer. "Mr. Nubbins," the chancellor began, removing his spectacles, I must admit that I have often wondered why we so seldom see athletes in here, what with all the speculation that goes on about the ethics of those who reside in Farley Hall. I know I should not let my personal feelings become involved, but I've always sensed that you jocks think you run this institution. Now, I'm not a varsity athlete myself, Mr. Nubbins. Oh, in high school I played a little basketball and was conference champion in the 200 butterfly, but I guess when they got around to handing out the scholarships... Oh, well, that's neither here nor there. What I'm here to tell you this evening, Mr. Nubbins, is that I am now a serious student here at Southeastern, and there are many of us serious students here, Mr. Nubbins, students who don't get their way paid by rich uncle over in Farley Hall. Read me? It's too bad that you have to bear the brunt for all the ones who have done the same thing you have and gotten away with it, but I don't know any other way to bring the message home that you jocks don't run this campus. He paused as if regaining his composure somewhat, and added as an almost understood afterthought, "We politicos do." "This is your sentence, Mr. Nubbins. You are hereby suspended from this university indefinitely." There was a perfect silence in the courtroom. Such was the demented sincerity of this last diatribe that many of the on-watchers, though they knew it was a farce, were actually a little mortified at the Chancellor's rancor. There was much sullen gaping going on, as if no one knew exactly how to end the whole ordeal. Nubbins just stood quaking, his mouth a small, dark cave. He stared unbelieving at the still bristling judge. Suddenly the court photographer ran out of the spectators' section, snapped a flash picture of Cassidy and Nubbins, and scurried back. Cassidy could no longer control himself. Weakly, he bent at the waist, held his stomach with both hands, and began making deep, resonant yelps, not unlike the fierce mating call of the male peacock. Nubbins looked over at him. His own lawyer found the penalty so harsh he could not keep from laughing. That broke the dam, of course, and the entire courtroom was quickly engulfed in a giant spasm of raucous laughter. With a wild clamor, the teary-eyed actors and half-paralyzed spectators began stumbling over feebly to shake hands with the defendant and pound his back gleefully. The little runner's wide eyes did not blink as his head swiveled back and forth, a berserk lighthouse. He thought, "How can anyone be so cruel as to actually enjoy seeing me get booted out of school? And my own lawyer is still laughing. Did he find it amusing, too?" Even the judge, black robes flowing, came down and threw his arm around Nubbins's shoulder, barking all the while. Betty Sue sat amid the considerable confusion with a vague smile on her face, wondering what in the bejesus was going on. She knew one thing. Old Jack had done something wonderful, and she was very proud. 14. Indoors. Winter arrived in the panhandle in its usual desultory fashion, a time of bright, cool days, chilly rains, fading landscapes. The harsh glare of those cloudless days muted the grass, the moss-draped oaks, and sometimes the higher callings of the spirit. "It is easier to train hard up north," Denton told them. "Snow is snow. You either run in it or you don't. It gives you something to go against, an irritant, but also a stimulus, if you know what I mean. Down here, the freezing rain runs down your neck one day, next day you'd think spring had sprung in January." "What's wrong with that?" Cassidy asked. "Such a winter is always getting your hopes up." But winter was the indoor season, and for Cassidy it was a time of renewed hopes. He had had his cross-country drubbings. Now he longed to turkey-trot a victory lap. "I've just had an odd thought," said Cassidy, looking out the oval porthole, enjoying the crisp, heady vacuum of jet flight.
"Do tell."
Denton looked up from his botany journal. "Here we are, flying several miles high across the eastern seaboard. Look, that must be Savannah. flying across the eastern seaboard a couple of thousand miles at a cost of several hundreds of dollars so that we can take off our street clothes, put on little kangaroo skin slippers that weigh about 3 ounces each, and shag ass around a little board track for exactly 1 mile. Two in your case. And there are these people, thousands of them, who live in skyscrapers of block and glass and who will pay money to come and watch us do it. This is the culmination of man's technology, zipping us along at 600 miles per hour. Maybe it just means that civilization has progressed to the point where it can afford even the most esoteric of specialties, even in sports. We are the athletic equivalent of pickled bee's knees in the gourmet section at the Winn-Dixie. Ha! This last took Cassidy by surprise. He looked over and Denton smiled back sweetly, letting Cassidy know once more that there are some people you do not take for granted, even for a second. Cross-country had ended surprisingly. At the AAU National Championships in Chicago's Washington Park, Cassidy, to his own great surprise, kept the leaders in view almost the entire race, finishing with frozen slush halfway up his calves in 15th place, four ahead of Meisner. He had never beaten the younger runner at any distance over 2 miles. Denton won the race with such ease that the other top cross-country men, stacked up in the finish chute, simply shook their heads in discouragement, even as they bent to their knees, still gasping from the effort. Denton seemed more delighted with Cassidy's finish than he was to win yet another national title. He even did a little jig as Cassidy, sprinting through the mud to edge out an Oregon runner, sailed into the chute with a grimace. A few seconds later, they were all standing around in the slush, laughing, though still out of breath, kicking mud at one another. Even Meisner, disappointed as he was, seemed to have a good time, though Cassidy could see he was worried. Cross-country, to Cassidy's immense relief, was over for another year. In lane 6, wearing number 278, from Southern California, the PAC champion... The announcer was going into the introduction for the 2 mile, the longest running event in the Millrose Games in Madison Square Garden. Cassidy jogged out onto the track to take Denton's sweats from him. The other 2 milers milled around with constrained nervousness. Some trotted back and forth in their lanes, some bounced up and down. It was a time of cruel stress. One race represented months of training, each step the product of many miles of preparation. They would have thought of this race countless times, some of them running it in bits and pieces during interval training or over distance. They would have thought of creeping up to Denton's shoulder with a lap to go. That sort of fantasy could get them through long hours on the road at night. But with the starting gun only seconds away, their heads were roaring with anticipation and anguish. They wanted to be into it. They wanted to be over it. The race itself was bearable, for that they had trained. The waiting, however, was hell on square wheels. Denton handed Cassidy the navy blue sweat top with USA in red and white piping, a status symbol, the sign of a member of a national team. Two other runners in the field wore the same kind of sweats. This would not be a stroll. "Hang in there," Cassidy said quietly. "Yeah." Denton was glazed over in concentration, even for a race that he surely couldn't consider very important. He was not a classical indoor runner. Both he and Cassidy were too tall to maneuver the banked turns as easily as the shorter runners. And Denton never, never took a race for granted. Though he said little, Cassidy knew he was appreciative of having someone there to offer small comforts. In lane 3, 2-time AAU 6-mile champion, 1-time 3-mile champion, twice member of our Olympic team. They were getting into the heavies now. Cassidy took the sweats, swatted Denton on the rear, and jogged to the infield to watch. And in lane 1, the crowd was already beginning to rumble. Representing Southeastern University Track Club and the United States... It was difficult to hear now. Ladies and gentlemen, the Olympic gold medalist in the 5,000-meter run... Bruce Denton trotted forward in his lane with a serene little wave, even though he had not heard his name. No one had. This was what that one perfectly executed race and the thousands of miles of training it required had earned him. The right to have his name lost in the uncontrolled frenzy of this crowd. Denton was thinking, I only won by 3 yards. Such adulation had roared down for him many times since he first heard it, sprinting down the straightaway in the Olympic Stadium. He would surely hear it many times again in his life. But as Denton trotted out and wistfully accepted it once more, Quentin Cassidy thought his smile seemed sad indeed. And entering the final lap now, ladies and gentlemen. The starter's gun went off with a loud crack. Gun lap. Gold medalist Bruce Denton followed by... It was all meaningless. The pack was a full half lap behind, running for places. Denton cavorted. He ran wide up on the banked turn and zipped back down onto the straightaway, playing roller coaster. Cassidy shook his head. Here he was racing some of the best distance men in the country, and he was playing around. When Denton crossed the finish line, Cassidy trotted up alongside and handed him his sweats. Denton, despite the ease with which he had won, was in no condition to talk. He took the sweats, grinned at Cassidy, and jogged on. He occasionally waved as a section of the audience stood to cheer when he passed beneath them. Cassidy shook his head, ran slowly to the outer hallway to complete his warm-up. His race was in 35 minutes, according to the almost universally unreliable schedule. Cassidy had ripped the order of events out of the program and was careful to check his watch often. By listening to the announcer, he would be able to tell how far behind the meet was running, and thus time his warm-up accurately. The large, cold hallway did not make a complete circuit, but it was roomy. Brightly colored sweatsuits flashed by at various speeds. Cassidy had jogged the elliptical half-circle 3 times by the time Denton came out to find him. Even now, his face was red, his voice hoarse from the harsh, smoky air. "Want company?" It was a rhetorical question. Here in this chilly, foreign environment, with so many talented athletes everywhere, it was easy to get psyched out. Cassidy knew no one here except Bruce. He was already beginning to ask himself the eternal self-doubt question, "What am I doing here?" But now he wasn't just some nobody in a Southeastern University sweatsuit jogging back and forth. He was the guy with Bruce Denton. His stride took on a proud bounce. "Do you know any of these guys in the mile?" he asked Denton. The older runner took the list and studied it as they ran. "Well, Marcel Philippe, you know. He's a Fordham guy. Can't be in real good shape yet. O'Rourke, I'm sure you remember. Kerry Ellison, Texas El Paso. Tough cookie. Those guys get in shape early like we do. I'd say he's the man to watch." "I didn't think he..." "He doesn't run on the cross-country team is why you didn't see him at Nationals. They have a bunch of true six-milers, so he doesn't have to." "No, he'll be in shape. Wouldn't be here otherwise." "Yeah, but what about old..." "LaQuarrie is scratched."
"Scratched? Jeez."
"Breaks your heart, doesn't it? I talked to him a few minutes ago. He's in pretty good shape, but he sprained his ankle a few days ago. I hate to say this, but it looks like you might have a chance to take all the marbles."
"Bruce, I..."
His forehead wrinkled with concern.
"Bruce, the Wanamaker mile.
Look, this is the way it happens. You keep at it hard, just like you've been doing. You hang around the fringes waiting for your chance. When it comes, you go for it. Hard. You do good, that gets you psyched. You go back, work even harder."
He stopped for a moment, reflected, then laughed. "Hell, I don't know. Who the hell knows?"
"The Milrose Mile. All I know is that you could win the thing. Your best races are the ones where you just relax and let it flow. You've got great speed, Cass. Geez, I wish I had it. All you have to do is keep from fretting it away early. It doesn't do any good anyway, indoors especially. Avoid hassles. When you make your move, go around the problems and stay around them.
You can run behind just fine so long as you don't get lulled into a bad place late in the race. If you're in a good spot, don't panic, even if you're a little crowded. Hang in there and hum a little tune. Talk to yourself, look at the girls, anything. Just stay in contact and get yourself to a good position with 2 laps to go. Don't wait until it's too late to get to your spot. You just don't make up really big gaps indoors, especially on this track. Yeah, it's a little slow, isn't it? It's pretty bad for the sprinters, but okay for us. A little spongy is all. I don't think it will affect you that much, but since you push off strongly from your calves, you might try to get a little more float out of your stride instead of trying to get oomph from the track. It doesn't have it to give. Got it. Want to do some striders with me? Striders? Striders? Hell, I just did an 8:32 deuce and you want me to do striders with you just to keep you company? He took off down the concrete hallway in a sprint, scattering runners in all directions. Cassidy smiled. It was always a great feeling to have it over with. 4 laps to go and it's O'Rourke of East Tennessee, Philippe of Fordham, Ellison, Cassidy, Wheeler, and Hector Ortiz of Western Kentucky. Cassidy tried to make his mind work. 11 laps to the mile, 2¾ equals 1 regular lap. Unaccustomed to gauging fatigue versus distance remaining on an indoor track, he had to make conversions as he went along. A runner is a miser, spending the pennies of his energy with great stinginess, constantly wanting to know how much he has spent and how much longer he will be expected to pay. He wants to be broke at precisely the moment he no longer needs his coin. He calculated. Outdoors, it would be the 3rd lap. For the time being, he was content to tuck in with the middle of the pack and wait for something to happen. The pace had not been impressive. Cassidy felt comfortable with it. They had gone through the half in 2:02 in a bunch. Each time he went by the far turn, Bruce Denton, arch fan, was one voice among 15,000 who called just for him. Denton yelled things that were not in the least irritating, like most of the things you hear during a race. Things like, pick it up, or faster, faster, don't let them get away. Things that make the runner think, if you think it's so damn slow, why don't you goddamn well get out here and pick it up yourself? Instead, Denton said, good pace, Cass, hang right there. Or, good position, stay alert. To the runner, traveling at a dizzying 15 miles per hour around a tiny oval track, entranced by pace concentration, the idea of staying alert seemed positively brilliant. With no warning and but 2 laps to go, Kerry Ellison surged powerfully. His brown legs flashed smoothly as he let out a burst of brutal speed. Cassidy responded immediately by pulling out, but he had to wait for a straightaway to pass the 2 runners in front of him. Damn! Then he realized with a sinking heart what Denton had said to him on each of the last 2 laps. Move up now! Move up now! But he had not heeded. Now he was just where he didn't want to be, in a bad position late in the race. The gun went off as they banked into the penultimate turn. By now Cassidy had pulled back to within 10 yards of the flying Texan. With growing confidence, he crept steadily up to Ellison's shoulder, using the entire far straight to do it, but feeling, though fatigued from the pace, that he had spirit left. He had gotten out of the jam by responding immediately to Ellison's bid, and he seemed to have something left to throw into it. He was excited and just as curious as the spectators to find out what was going to happen. The crowd, on its feet since the crack of the gun, didn't seem to care who won. They just wanted a race. The excitement of the approaching finish yarn, as always, caused a little prickly feeling at the back of his neck. Cassidy started to pass on the final turn, but just as he pulled up and began the effort, he heard Denton through the din. No! That was all he said. This time, Cassidy heard. He hung on Ellison's shoulder all through the tiny turn, and with a gasp, flung himself out and into the final straight. Ellison was not finished either. He pumped smoothly and leaned into his final sprint. But Quentin Cassidy was by far the faster kicker. He easily gained 7 yards on Ellison in the last straight. From the crowd came a subdued roar that signified the anticlimax. Denton jumped up onto the track and trotted up to where Cassidy was bent over in the familiar grasping position. "Don't grab those knees, boy," he shouted above the din. Here are your sweats. Get them on. But don't you grab those knees, though, because you got to run a little of that off. You have just become the Wanamaker Mile champion, and you got to let them know. Cassidy's face was the old fire engine color, and his breathing still desperate.
No. What?
He tried to jog, but it felt as if his spine were made of bamboo. Nothing worked properly. Lactic acid bound him into a solid block. He could not swing his arms.
That it feels good.
Denton seemed much happier at the moment than his young friend. On the plane, Cassidy was a zombie again, smiling vacantly but apparently unable to assimilate what was going on around him. They had gone out to eat and hadn't gotten to bed until 2 in the morning. Denton insisted they take a token morning run, so they clomped around stiffly in the gray Manhattan morning. Denton assured him most muggers did not work early. Cassidy barely made it to his seat. The stewardess woke him to ask if he wanted breakfast. He did, and woke him again a few minutes later when she brought it. When they arrived in Philadelphia, Denton woke him again.
Hey, champ, end of the line. All milers off.
Cassidy mumbled something and then snoozed while the other passengers slowly departed. He nodded off gently while Denton got a cab, and then slept soundly all the way to the hotel as Denton sat in the front seat and chatted with the driver.
"What's wrong with your buddy?" the driver asked.
"Wanamaker syndrome," Denton said. "Subclinical. Real pity is the guy used to be a fine athlete."
"Too bad," clucked the driver.
"Hey, Rip, time for grub. Let's get it on."
It was Denton again. Cassidy thought, he's enjoying himself, there's no doubt about it.
I don't think I'm going to live, he told Denton.
They've got great clam chowder at this place only a couple of blocks away, said Denton as he dressed. Also a nice little ribeye steak that I, for one, would not miss on a bet.
What the hell is that?
Cassidy pointed out the window.
That, my boy, is snow. White stuff that falls from God. It won't hurt you, actually, as long as you don't swallow any or carry it in your pocket. Some people claim it has magical powers, try to put on long wooden planks and slide on it. Personally, I don't think it'll catch on.
Come on! Get your ass in gear! I'm starving!
Despite himself, once they were out in the cold air walking to the restaurant, Cassidy started to feel better. After he had some tea, he tried to snap out of it altogether.
I don't understand how I can have jet lag in my own time zone. How do you do this all winter?
This?
Denton crumbled some crackers into his chowder.
This, my boy, is fine. This is your reward for getting into shape early, because these northern sharpies won't fly you in from the coast or Florida to run in their shows unless they know you can produce. Hell, they could get a fairly respectable field in the Mile or Deuce from the New York-Boston area if they had to.
We furnish an element of the exotic.
You'd best get used to the idea if you keep winning. A 4013 is not a bad time, indoors. Especially on that sponge cake track in the garden. That might be worth, oh, come on, Bruce. That might be worth a 3...
Cut it out, Bruce!
A 358 or so, Cass.
He looked up seriously from his chowder. Cassidy sipped his tea morosely. These things were not to be bantered about lightly. It was bad luck to put your mouth on times your feet couldn't reach. Denton got up to talk to someone at the cashier.
Who is that? Cassidy asked.
Someone who is going to make your evening interesting.
Come on.
Just don't try any of that last straightaway kicking crap like last night, or you'll hear someone behind you snickering.
Bruce, who?
Sammy Bear.
Shit.
The Philadelphia meet was a classic second meet of the weekend letdown. Denton won in 8:44 from an undistinguished field, and Cassidy ran 4:05.2 for second. Sam Bear didn't laugh at him, but he might as well have. By the time they were seated on the plane the next morning, Cassidy was back in his walking coma.
You gonna have breakfast? chirped Denton as they strapped in. I mean, if you don't want her to wake you.
Bruce, you can have my goddamn breakfast. Why don't you just try to cheer up a little?
He dropped off into a sleep that didn't abate until they reached Atlanta, where they changed planes. He didn't dream. 15. Casualty. The splenetic fireplug of a nurse turned the page of her Cosmo juicily, saw it was going to get pretty good, and elected to take a pit stop before going on. The article was entitled, Your SQ, Sexual Quotient, Rating Yourself in the Boudoir. As soon as she toddled off, the vigilant Quentin Cassidy tossed aside his National Geographic, I Lived with the Bagarak Mountain Apes by Dr. Jane Tully Wells, one for the Neo-Freudians, he thought, grabbed the aromatic flat box and sprinted for the stairwell. This was past visiting hours. This was illegal. This was keno-nito fun. He sashayed into Meisner's room with the box in his upturned fingers, singing in a lusty, though muted voice, Cara mia huay. Meisner, shh. Cassidy moaned, There's a village called Sorrento. Meisner, that goddamn old bat of a... in the can. Oh. Meisner sat up in bed, pale in his old sweatshirt, a faded dusty purple job with the traditional winged foot, and the nearly illegible legend, Pompano Beach Track. Cassidy scurried around, setting up. He stuffed a towel in the crack under the door. He pulled up a chair and produced with considerable flourish the two cans of beer, one from each pocket. Meisner applauded quietly. Had Cassidy stood still for just a moment and really looked at his friend, real tears might have slid down his fleshless cheekbones. Meisner was what they called a hurtin' swamp dog. But he told Cassidy, You bring such joy into my heart. In a dreamy, nearly dopey voice, this was. They attacked the disc, which, although containing mostly squashed tomatoes and fermented animal parts, the Italians will scarcely claim. Even after Meisner threw in his napkin, Cassidy kept on eating, primarily because he wanted something to do. He was still unstable here. So tell me about Milrose, damn it. Every detail. Do not stint. Do not leave out a spike hole or a careless elbow, Meisner said impatiently. The Kernsville Sun captured it quite well, actually, Cassidy said, following their normal tradition of printing straight wire copy, despite the fact two local heroes did good. Let's see. LaQuarrie scratched, bless his little heart. No foreigners for some reason, maybe immigration rounding them all up or something. Just me and Ellison in the last lap. I kind of slipped up on him after the bell, and when we got to the last straight, I pulled the trigger. For a second, I didn't think anything was going to happen. Then it caught, and I blew by him. I actually ended up getting him by 7, but he probably eased off when he saw I wasn't going to come back to him. Bruce was beside himself. I think he has decided that he, you know, discovered me or something. Despite the fact that I had to run a 4.3 last year before he hardly said more than hello. How did his race go? Oh, he just blew them right off the track. Art DuLong, Drayton, and that guy from Minnesota. They were never even in it. He ran 8:32 like it was a workout. Meisner shook his head. It would have been great to see. Both of you. But Cassidy knew what he was saying. So what is the word here? Is it confirmed? Shit, yes. They think maybe 3-4 months of no training. Even then, it's touch and go because of the possibility of relapses. But at least I get out of here pretty soon. Well, hey, at least you didn't blow your eligibility. Except for cross-country. Very quietly, this last. Hey, listen, I already have a complete list of the silver linings. It's the goddamn cloud that's killing me. Yeah. Cassidy looked at his feet. There were no good words for this one, he thought. A runner who could not run was out of his element. He would not even think of himself as an athlete. Ridiculously, there would be a kind of guilt about it. That was the worst part. He would begin to feel uncomfortable around his training comrades, and the feeling would be mutual, like a newly wounded soldier among the embarrassed whole ones who would not wish to be reminded of certain roll-the-dice aspects of life. Cassidy was not surprised when Meisner told him he was going to move out of Doobie Hall for the next quarter. This was getting them both down. Meisner sensed it and changed the subject. "What's happening with all the yelling and screaming on the haircut rules?"
I wish I knew. It seems they are really serious about the thing. I hear they've been cracking down around Farley Hall, measuring sideburns with little rulers, making guys change shirts before they let them eat, stuff like that. Real, you know, brilliant stuff from the football minds over there. Even the football players are mad as hell. Nothing has happened at Doobie yet, but everyone figures they just haven't quite gotten around to us.
Jeez, and me stuck in the infirmary.
Consider yourself lucky. That goddamn Hosford volunteered my room for some kind of rabble-rousing meeting tonight. He looked at his watch irritably. I guess I'd better go. They might set fire to my Kip Kano poster or something.
He tossed his beer can into the trash can and winced as it clanged. He had forgotten.
Is there anything I can... Nah, I've got everything. The guys brought my books and stuff.
You better take off. Thanks for the pizza. I'd kiss you, but...
Cassidy laughed. Then I'd catch it too, and we could be roommates in here.
Look, you take care of yourself, you hear?
I know this is a pretty rough deal.
Well, the tour was getting to me a little, you know? I mean, Akron one night, Utica the next. Now at least I can take the time to work on my steps and follow through.
And coming over the ball, don't forget to come over the ball.
Meisner laughed. No doubt. Hey, Cass, really, congratulations on Milrose. I think it's just great. You should have heard me when I read the paper Saturday morning. They thought I had slipped and broken my ass on the way to the John or something.
Cassidy nodded, smiled at him, and turned for the door just as it opened brusquely. The white-stockinged fireplug stood glaring at him.
You! She cried. Cassidy leaned over and solemnly kissed her on the forehead, then sprinted out the door, dodging a relatively serious swat with her rolled-up Cosmo. On his way back to Doobie, walking along with his hands jammed in his pockets away from the chilly evening, he was filled with loss and an off-brand of nostalgia for events that were supposed to become part of his past, but now wouldn't at all. In his mind's special processes, a 10-mile run takes far longer than the 60 minutes reported by a grandfather clock. Such time, in fact, hardly exists at all in the real world. It is all out on the trail somewhere, and you only go back to it when you are out there. He and Mize had been through 2 solid years of such regular time warp escapes together. There was something different about that, something beyond friendship. They had a way of sharing pain, of transferring hurt back and forth without the banality of words. But now, in the vague recesses of his mind, Cassidy detected deep and sinister rumblings, storm clouds that chilled the air but were not yet visible on the horizon. And, too, he did not do well with hospitals and infirmaries, repositories of laboratory smells, lethal-looking silverware, launching pads for flagging hopes.
16. New Territory. Quentin Cassidy had returned from his daily afternoon visit to Meisner and now sat in his darkening room feeling not so much despair as nerve-jangling emptiness. The scenery was closing in on him. Low blood pH, he thought. The trick is to keep from getting nervous in the pack, like Bruce says. Think of how anchovies must swim 1,000 to a square yard with a perfect twin on either side and a tiny bung flitting up ahead. The Kernsville Sun lay in a heap at the foot of the bed. He had stopped trying to read when the sun got too low, and he realized he was too tired to get up and turn on the light. So he just sat, staring out the window. It was slim pickings in the limp little sheet anyway, warmed over wire stories, a hard-hitting editorial on sewage bonds, an irate letter from a lady complaining about a neighbor's dog shitting in her azaleas, and sports editor Jack Hairlep's column urging full support for Dick Doobie's next season. There was a quote from the coach about some real fine junior college transfers who are going to be a real great help to us out there next year. At that point, Cassidy had tossed the paper, idly wondering if Hairlep drew his salary from the newspaper or just picked up his check on Friday from the athletic department's publicity office. Perhaps he was too hard on the local Gazette. There was, after all, real news in the human interest vein on page 2A, under the Smile for the Day logo. It seems that somewhere out in the great American night, a felonious ebony hand had skillfully slid a flat piece of steel down a car window, allowing a hopped-up connoisseur of spot remover to become the temporary, if illegal, bailee of a Ford Fairlane with transmission problems. Thrown into the deal was a dark green garbage bag in the back seat, the contents of which were exactly someone's dead mother-in-law. Cassidy had thought, oh, this is a fun-loving citizenry.
Hey, how come it's so dark in here?
Hosford wandered in, cracking his knee on the edge of the dresser. I'm afraid if I turn on a light, I'll look in the mirror and see that I look as bad as I feel, Cassidy said, but not uncheerfully.
Ah, well, mind if I sit down? Hey, the sun, anything in here?
As usual, the only important message is contained in Doonesbury. Well, as it happens, I bring news myself. I hope it's not bad. Western Union guy just brought it a few minutes ago. I thought you were asleep, so I signed for it.
Telegram?
Thanks, Hoss. I'll mosey along, I guess. Hey, listen.
Hey! This is open.
Congratulations, Cass. All the guys think it's just great.
All the... Hosford! Come back here, you nosy son of a bitch!
Bruce? Sorry to call you during dinner, but you'll never guess.
You got invited to the Sunkissed games next weekend, Denton said.
Cassidy slumped.
How the hell did you know?
I talked to the meat director when we were at Milrose.
What did he say?
He wanted to know if I thought you could go under 4 minutes on his track in San Diego.
And?
I asked him, can a fish hold his breath underwater?
Cassidy yelped, then calmed himself.
Wonderful, Bruce. I haven't even run that outdoors yet.
Life is short. Life is hard.
You're running the 3 there?
Right.
Good field?
I don't know what you call good. Just shorter and a bunch of...
Shorter?
You'd think the little marathoner bastard would stick to the great outdoors. Unfortunately, he seems to like the boards. And in case it slipped your mind, he once held the American record for 2 mile indoors. On that very track.
How do you think you'll handle him, Bruce?
Was that concern in his voice? Denton rattled around on his end for a few seconds. Cassidy couldn't tell what he was doing.
Why, Quentin? I'll break his back.
Braggadocio has little to do with it, however, when the really good boys clash and everyone is feeling chipper. The 2 gold medalists broke away from the field early and were soon circling the track at a distressing pace that quickly found most of the other runners lapped. Although Denton's credentials were in a race slightly longer than 3 miles and shorter's in the marathon, their training was remarkably similar. The crowd was standing during the last half mile. The lead changed 3 times as they probed at each other. Denton's long, powerful strides were matched by Shorter's clipped, silky ones. The marathoner was so smooth as to give the impression of gliding on wheels. The strain of the pace showed around the edges of their otherwise unemotional faces. Cassidy watched in awe as they threw surges at each other.
Shit fire, Cassidy thought. This is awful. We need some relief.
His shouts were lost in the general pandemonium as the 2 runners entered the final lap, with Denton slightly in front and Shorter on his outside shoulder. Cassidy figured it was highly unlikely that the marathoner would be able to outsprint a 5,000-meter champion, but his joyous victory whoop came just a trifle too early. It was a doubly painful revelation to watch the all-too-clear demonstration of mortality that was the last lap of that race. Frank Shorter had to break an American indoor record for 3 miles, and his margin of victory was exactly 0.1 seconds, but there was no doubt whatsoever that when Bruce Denton reached the finish line, he had the unique experience of finding the yarn already parted for him. Cassidy was stunned. Despite the incredible effort of their contest, the two runners were soon coherent enough to be interviewed by a particularly irrelevant Howard Cosell. Cassidy waited outside the glow of hot television lights in a pale haze of his own confusion. He had never seen Denton lose a race, and he wasn't sure yet how he felt. When the interview was over, Denton and Shorter left the infield together and sprinted through a veritable tidal wave of little kids waving programs and pens. Denton turned, spotted Cassidy, motioned for him to join them. When the miler caught up to the pair of distance men in the hallway, they were already lost in the numerical shorthand of training talk. Shorter was reserved, shy, yet with a sweetness that seemed positively contrary to the aggression he summoned up for his competitors. His eyes reflected that irony. Cassidy wanted to ask him 100 questions, but he bit his tongue. He was, in truth, a bit flabbergasted. First, he had watched Denton out-sprinted by a marathoner, and now he and that marathoner were jogging along chatting about training like it was old home week. Denton had never mentioned that he even knew Shorter. Cassidy only half-listened to the mumble of mileage figures. At altitude, of course, and then 123, 132, 137, and 145, but with only 2 interval sessions a week. And a long one on Sunday, about 20. Louise goes the first 10 with us. Step down, starting with a 412 mile and a 302 3/4. Then 35 times 220, all of them pretty quick for me, 28 to 30 or so. And so on. It was quiet for several seconds before he realized he had been spoken to. "I'm sorry," Cassidy said. "I said Milrose. You won Milrose 2 weeks ago, didn't you?" Shorter was being polite, trying to include him in the conversation. Yes. The field wasn't that strong, you see. Well, anyone who can run close to 4 on that track gets my respect. I think they made it out of pound cake dyed green. At least no one will get shin splints on the thing. I hate to interrupt a medical discussion, Denton said, pointing to a clock on the wall, but I believe it's time for the stud milers among us to be doing some striders. This is one meet they generally manage to run on time. Mr. Shorter here finished the 3 so quickly he put them several minutes ahead. Cassidy held out his hand to Shorter. "Hey, it was nice to meet you. Do you have any parting words for an aspiring young runner?" Shorter looked puzzled, amused. He looked over at Denton and smiled back at Cassidy. "Well, no, not actually, except have a good time." Denton laughed and waved Cassidy off. "That one," Denton said, tilting his head at the departing miler. "Keep your eye on that one." Shorter nodded. That night, Quentin Cassidy ran the best mile of his life and thereby changed his position in the tiny universe of runners nearly imperceptibly. He ran 4.1, and, of course, would never be quite the same. But his race was also a different kind of revelation. And although Denton tried several times on the flight back to put things into perspective for him, Cassidy knew he was on the fearful and nebulous border of new territory. He finished 5th, and was lucky to get that. 17. Breaking Down. Cassidy had been through it before. Every one of them had at one time or another, but it had never been quite this bad. Denton called it breaking down, although Cassidy preferred the nomenclature of certain Caribbean quasi-religious groups. Walking death was much closer to it.
quite a bit more, really, than the simple exhaustion of a single difficult workout, breaking down was a cumulative physical morbidity that usually built up over several weeks and left the runner struggling to recover from one session to the next. The object, according to Denton, was to run through the thing, just as he maintained one should attempt to run through most of those other little hubcaps life rolls into your lane. Everything from death in the family to cancer of the colon. Breaking down was not a required checkpoint on the road to competitive fitness. In fact, many coaches warned against it. But Denton viewed it as an opportunity to leapfrog over months of safer, less strenuous training, thus tempering survival-hardened muscles. The alternative, total rest, was too much the other extreme, the easy way out. That wouldn't do. The toll on the runner and those around him was high, psychologically as well as physically. He became weak, depressed, and needed 12 to 14 hours of sleep a night. He was literally desperate for rest, spent his waking hours with his legs elevated in a state of general irritability. He became asexual, rendered, in the words of the immortal Limerick, really quite useless on dates. He was a thoroughly unpleasant person. But then his life was most certainly focused on the task, and hadn't he decided at one time that he would do whatever was necessary to become whatever it was he could become? Perhaps. But at this juncture, many a runner begins to re-examine some of the previously unexamined premises. The question that plagues the runner undergoing breakdown training is, why am I living like this? The question eventually becomes, is this living? From the crucible of such inner turmoil come the various metals, soft or brittle, flawed or pure, precious or common, that determine the good runners, the great runners, and perhaps the former runners. For those who cannot deal with or evade the consequences of their singular objective will simply fade away from it all and go on to less arduous pursuits. There has probably never been one yet who has done so, however, without leaving a part of himself there in the quiet, tiled solace of the early afternoon locker room, knotting his loathsome-smelling laces for yet another, Jesus God, 10-miler with the boys. Once a runner? Cassidy always felt that those who partook of the difficult pleasures of the highly competitive runner only when comfortable, when in a state of high energy, when rested, elated, or untroubled by previous exertions, such dilettantes missed the point. They were the ones who showed up at the beginning of the season, perhaps hung on for a few rough periods, maybe ran a race or two. But Cassidy noticed that their eyes always gave them away. The gloom, one could tell, was too much for them. It would soon engulf them. They would begin to ask themselves the questions too many times. Soon they would miss a workout, then a few in a row. Then they would chicken out on themselves during the tough, stupid, endless middle of a bad race. And you don't easily hide such things from yourself, much less your teammates. Soon, when the questions were posed, there would be no answers. The runner would begin to feel self-conscious around the others, knowing that he was no longer one of them. Eventually, he would drift off and be a runner no more. Quentin Cassidy's method of dealing with fundamental doubts was simple. He didn't think about them at all. These questions had been considered a long time ago, decisions made, answers recorded, and the book closed. If it had to be reopened every time the going got rough, he would spend more time rationalizing than training. His log would start to disclose embarrassing information, perhaps blank squares. Even a self-made obsessive-compulsive could not tolerate that. He was uninterested in the perspective of the fringe runners, the philosopher runners, the training rats, those who sat around reading abstruse and meaningless articles in Runner's World, coining yet more phrases to describe the indescribable, waxing mystical over the various states of euphoria that the anointed were allegedly privy to. On the track, the Cassidys of the world ate such specimens alive. Cassidy sought no euphoric interludes. They came, when they did, quite naturally, and he was content to enjoy them privately. He ran not for crypto-religious reasons, but to win races, to cover ground fast. Not only to be better than his fellows, but better than himself. To be faster by a tenth of a second, by an inch, by 2 feet or 2 yards than he had been the week or year before. He sought to conquer the physical limitations placed upon him by a three-dimensional world, and if time is the fourth dimension, that too was his province. If he could conquer the weakness, the cowardice in himself, he would not worry about the rest. It would come. Training was a rite of purification. From it came speed, strength. Racing was a rite of death. From it came knowledge. Such rites demand, if they are to be meaningful at all, a certain amount of time spent precisely on the red line, where you can lean over the manicured putting green at the edge of the precipice and see exactly nothing. Anything else that comes out of that process was byproduct. Certain compliments and observations made him uneasy. He explained that he was just a runner, an athlete, really, with an absurdly difficult task. He was not a health nut, was not out to mold himself a stylishly slim body. He did not live on nuts and berries. If the furnace was hot enough, anything would burn, even Big Macs. He listened carefully to his body and heeded strange requests. Like a pregnant woman, he sometimes sought artichoke hearts, pickled beets, smoked oysters. His daily toil was arduous, satisfying on the whole, but not the bounding, joyous nature romp described in the magazines. Other runners, real runners, understood it quite well. Quentin Cassidy knew what the mystic runners, the joggers, the runner poets, the Zen runners, and others of their ilk were talking about. But he also knew that their euphoric selves were